Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Nicholas Davidoff has pretty much done it all when it comes to nonfiction writing, memoir, biography, anthology, and done it all well. The Fly Swatter, his book about his grandfather, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in 2003. His first book, though, The Catcher Was a Spy, The Mysterious Life of Mo Berg, is considered the definitive biography of one of baseball's most intriguing characters. Davidoff followed that one up by editing Baseball, a Literary Anthology, which I consider one of the best of its kind. Both of these titles are included in the 501 baseball books fans must read before they die. So when I heard that Davidoff was going to be the featured speaker at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse this Wednesday, I knew it was time for a bookshelf conversation. Nicholas Davidoff, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Of all the characters in baseball, how did you come to pick Mo Berg as a subject for your biography?
Well, I first heard about Mo Berg when I was reading an anthology of excellent baseball writing that was edited by a guy named John Thorne, who was, to my knowledge, then the person who probably knew the most of anybody in the world about baseball. He just seemed to know everything, and I had this anthology that he'd edited, and there was this essay in it called Pitchers and Catchers by a guy named Mo Berg, and it said in Thorne's introduction to the essay by Berg that Berg had been a spy, and that immediately interested me because while I loved sports and was very interested in sports, I wasn't only interested in sports, and I was then a young guy writing for Sports Illustrated, and I seemed to be the person there who straddled subjects. In other words, I was always writing about things that were both sports and something else, if that follows. And so here seemed to be the ultimate sports and something else guy, this man who'd been a professional baseball player, but baseball was kind of a day job, as an artist would put it. And for his real work, which initially was in foreign languages and then law, and then he was also interested in linguistics and briefly spent time in graduate school at Columbia before going to Columbia Law School. And then he'd gone on to have a long and distinguished in terms of personality career in Major League Baseball. And, I mean, to last as long as he did in Major League Baseball is an achievement anyway. He was in professional baseball for close to 20 years, which is hard at any time, and especially at that time when there are fewer teams. Anyway, and fewer public sporting endeavors to be a part of, right? But so then this little introduction said that he'd become a spy, and that really interested me. And nobody I knew knew anything about him. And then someone just coincidentally at Sports Illustrated asked me if I'd write about him. So that's how I began.
So the book was an extension of the article?
Yeah, it began as an article that a wonderful editor at Sports Illustrated named Myra Gelband called me into her office, and she knew that I was interested in sort of things that were both sports and real world and the connection between apparently non-sports related things and sports. This is sounding kind of tortured, but that's the way it was. And yeah, and so Myra Gelband asked me if I would write about Mo Berg, and I started writing about him. And then there's been this editor at Pantheon Books, at Random House, who had been asking me if I would be interested in writing books. And my real problem at Sports Illustrated is I always wanted to write much longer than there was space. It was not necessarily, I guess everybody has their natural length, and mine was probably longer than articles for the most part. And he'd been talking to me about various ideas for a book. And so we had lunch one day, and he said, "What are you up to?" And I told him, and he said, "You got to write a book for me about this." And I said, "Well, I thought about it, but, you know, I wouldn't want to emphasize the baseball too much because baseball was only a means to a personality in a way." Baseball, very quickly, Berg was not a significant baseball player except in terms of personality. And he said, that's exactly the book I want you to write. So that's how it began.
Well, was there any problem since you were doing the article for Sports Illustrated and writing the book for somebody else?
Problems? No. I mean, the article was finished before. I mean, I left Sports Illustrated.
I see.
But I had already completed the article. The article was finished. No. And it's very common that magazine articles become expanded into books, but it's the natural way for a writer to test both their interest and also how much, you know, how much a subject can sustain for a writer and, more important, for a reader. So, I mean, in my work ever since, I've always written articles as a way of getting a sense of subjects that interest me, whether or not they might turn into a book.
The title of the book was The Catcher Was a Spy, and it came out just about 20 years ago, correct?
Exactly 20 years ago.
Right. What kind of research was available for you at the time?
Oh, I talked to everybody in the world who I could find who knew Mo Berg. Anybody I could find out there in the world who had ever known him in any significant capacity, I tried to find them. And, of course, you can't find everyone. But right up into the end, I mean, I pretty much stopped. There's sort of, when you're writing books, there's a sort of a most people would probably say the same thing, and nobody could probably explain it. It's kind of ineffable. But you just kind of know when you're ready to write. And I remember having an idea that I was ready to write and not knowing how I knew, but knowing that I knew. And at that point, I talked to everyone I could find. I also, there were Berg documents scattered all over the place. And there was this guy named Charles Owen who was just a guy who got very interested and passionately so in Mo Berg. And he had some of Berg's papers that Berg's brother had given to him after Berg died. And Berg's brother had them, and then he turned them over to this man, Charles Owen. And Charles Owen let me see those papers and was very helpful to me. And there are archives all over the country that I visited. And there were people in Japan who had some sense of Berg, and I went there. And I went to, you know, and then there's the whole spying part of his life. And there's a guy named Thomas Powers who still probably remains the country's leading expert on intelligence matters, in other words, spying. And both the OSS and the CIA, and he was incredibly helpful to me and, you know, invited me to his home and spent an entire day with me, letting me look through documents in his files and guiding me. And then I went to Washington, and I spent a tremendous amount of time in the National Archives looking through the precursor to the OSS, which Berg worked for the CIA, which Berg worked for, was called the OSS, and that's basically the CIA during war, is the easiest way to put it. And that's who Berg worked for, as an atomic bomb spy. And there are just massive amounts of paper were generated, and it's all in Washington at the National Archives. And I was just at the National Archives day and night until they kicked me out, you know, for weeks and weeks. And I had a cousin who let me come and stay with him, and I was just there all the time. And eventually, you know, between that and Tom Powers, and then I would track down the names of people who I found in the papers in the archives, and if they were still alive. I mean, it was just I'm rambling a little bit, but it was a huge research project, and part of what made it such a challenging, exciting, but also difficult project was that this was a person whose life sort of vectored out in all sorts of ways. And, you know, his life touched many people in sort of glancing ways. And that tells you who he was, but it also makes it presents its own unique challenge for somebody who's writing his biography, because you can't just get a tremendous amount of information from one person. I mean, Berg never remarried. He didn't really have confidants. He was constantly on the move. And eventually that becomes his life, that he's someone who doesn't have deep, sustained relationships, and here's why, and here's who he was. But he really was a very interesting person. And one of the things I would also say about him is because there were such limitations to his life for a biographer, it was a very good first book because the project had natural limitations too. In other words, he was a really interesting person, but it wasn't like writing your first book about Abraham Lincoln, who had profound relationships and was involved in deep and profound, you know, national, civic, and cultural events. I mean, the big events that Berg was involved in were smaller events, although no less significant in his life, if that follows.
Now, one of the things that constantly comes up is the question of how much did he conflate his contributions to the spy world, so to speak. He on the one hand, he would tell people he couldn't tell them anything. On the other hand, he kind of faux bragged about his accomplishments. So what's the story on that? What, was he the real deal when it came to?
Oh, absolutely. He was a much better spy than he was baseball player. I think that's just the way he behaved was very strange, and it's the way no real spy behaves. But it has to do with the fact that during the war, he was a part of this very. It was a very unconventional group of people who were in the OSS, and their style was loose and baggy, and you have to understand that the CIA was operated as a really buttoned-down, professional, bureaucratic, serious organization, and the OSS was much more of a cowboying outfit. And Berg really liked it because he was by nature a freelancer. Berg's big project was to try and learn whether or not Germany had an atomic bomb. And he did a great job, but what he learned was that Germany probably didn't have anything other than a really inchoate, you know, really, really, in the very early stages at best, atomic bomb program. That's really crucial intelligence, but it's also invariably for a spy, if you discover something which is dangerous and about to happen, it seems like a more significant discovery, whereas if you discover the negative, that something isn't happening. So Berg felt, and justifiably so, that he'd done great work, and he had, but it wasn't really as appreciated as if he'd saved the day, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So when the war ends, his behavior was strange. He was always a pretty strange guy. I mean, he was a guy who, you know, kept a stack of newspapers every morning, and if you touched it, he wouldn't read it anymore. If your finger came near it, he'd say it's alive. He wore the same clothes every day. It was a sort of a Moberg uniform of a gray suit and a black tie and a white shirt, and he did this every day. So he went from a baseball uniform to a Moberg uniform, so to speak. He had all sorts of, to a reader and to a writer, very interesting personal eccentricities, but he called attention to himself, and that's the last thing a spy would want to do. And this wasn't a good thing, and when most people who worked for the OSS didn't work for the CIA, it was the organization was compressed and hugely, you know, in terms of personnel, it was a huge compression of personnel, and Berg was like lots and lots of other people, but he took it really badly because much as he liked being in the world of baseball, and he really did, you know, what's going to be your second act after baseball? In his second act, he'd found the one that was perfect for him, and then the CIA really didn't want him. So he spent the rest of his life running around the world sort of pretending to be a spy. And it was a funny thing because, of course, he had been a spy, and he really wasn't anymore, although there were a couple of sort of slight gestures in that direction. But for the most part, it's pretty tragic in that way, I think, although extremely inventive. You know, he became and was a person of huge personal originality, but he was also in some ways a really thwarted and disappointed man, and a man of, you know, really great talent. And so, you know, I was interested in him, and I admired him, and I felt for him, and I also, you know, looked at him as sort of a disappointment artist, too.
Is there an option for a movie on this?
Yeah. Invariably, it gets optioned. And, you know, the problem, the situation in Hollywood is simply that most movies that are most properties that are optioned aren't made. But it's almost always optioned at one point or another, and then it doesn't seem to be made. It's a difficult thing to make. You know, it's not a particularly happy ending for starters.
You mentioned early on in our conversation that you learned about Moberg through an anthology by John Thorne. You edited one of the best anthologies on the sports baseball, a literary anthology. How many items did you go through that finally ended up that, or let's put it this way, how many items did you go through and then you had to narrow down to what appears in the book? It's a massive book.
You know, baseball, more than any other sport, has generated exceptional writing, and there's also a whole history of writing. And when you're editing for the Library of America, you want your anthology to have the best writing there is, but you also want it to have a representative selection of the writing on any given subject throughout its history in this country. And so you wanted things that expressed the character of writing early in the days of baseball, and there's some. And then, you know, as the writing matures and as people figure out how to write about it more creatively and it reaches its apex with Roger Angel, there's more and more and more and more and more. And there are lots of good reasons why baseball has generated such excellent writing. And there was lots of excellent writing about it. And I can't remember anymore how – I doubt I ever counted. I mean, I read everything. We wrote to as many people as we could think of who would make suggestions to me about things that ought to be in the anthology. Then we had two different layers of committee which voted on things because I didn't want sole responsibility and I wanted as many different voices represented as possible. I was always, for example, looking for someone to write – who'd written something really wonderful about why they hated baseball, and preferably a woman, you know, who was dragged to games. You know, at a certain point, it was an American cliche, the woman who was dragged to sporting events by her boyfriend or husband or whatever it was. And I was sure that there must be some hilarious writer out there who'd written something really – I never found it. I had all these ideas about things that I might find. Or I also hoped to find some small-town muse who was writing about a local team who wrote about it in all sorts of really wonderful ways, but had never left, I don't know, a town in Nebraska or a town in, you know, New Mexico or something like that, who had just been – but I didn't find that either. I'm sure we missed tremendous amounts of really excellent writing, but that's always just testament to how much there is – that feeling is testament to just how much there is out there. And yeah, so there was a tremendous amount there, and it was a real and challenging project to try and winnow it down into something that would, you know, there were a prescribed number of page numbers. Something else I will say is that if we had to do it again, I can guarantee that some of the things that are in wouldn't be in, and some things mm-hmm. that aren't in would. I mean, but that's just the nature of taste. Anything in the arts, you know, is to some degree subjective, and we were well aware that. Would you call it a mistake, or would you call it just the nature of something that is, again, subjective? I don't know, but it is testament to just how much great writing is out there, from Roger Angel on down.
That was going to be my next question. Roger Angel is still with us. Red Smith is not. I'm wondering if there is anyone in this generation of writers who you think somewhere down the line might be included in any kind of revised edition that might be put out.
Oh, I can think of tons of things that would be in there right off the top of my head if they asked me, and I haven't really been thinking about it, so I'll just mention, you know, there's a great poet named Vijay Seshadri who won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry this year, but long before he was a famous poet, he wrote a piece about being an immigrant kid and being a fan of Roberto Clemente as an immigrant kid and what that was like. And it was in a little literary review. That's a great piece of writing. If I'd seen that, that definitely would have been in, but I didn't know about it. And, you know, it was in a fairly obscure literary review, as I remember. And, of course, Michael Lewis published Moneyball subsequent to the publication of the anthology. Naturally, there would be a section from Moneyball. That's one of the best books ever written about baseball, and so on. I mean, anything that's come out since, you know, would have to be reviewed by, again, these tiers of committees, and then we would decide, you know, what should be, what belongs and what doesn't.
So in addition to the Moberg biography, the literary anthology, you've written some memoirs, including The Crowd Sounds Happy. How difficult or easy was that to write, since it's your own story, compared to the other things for which you had to do research?
Oh, that was, well, I had to do research for that, too, but that began as a eulogy for my father, and then it became a New Yorker remembrance of my father, and then I thought that there was more to say. Something I'd always wanted to write was a coming-of-age stories are traditionally fiction, are traditionally novels, like, you know, everything from Tom Sawyer to My Antonia, right, or coming-of-age stories. And I'd always wanted, since I'm a nonfiction writer, I'd always wanted to try and write one that had the same sort of form and structure as the great coming-of-age stories, but was true, was a real, you know, nonfiction coming-of-age story. So that's what I tried to write there. But one of the things that I thought hard about was how I could make it as accurate as possible while still being a work of memory. And so there was lots of reporting to check my memories. And it was extremely challenging just because it's really a book, for the most part, not so much about me as about my family. And it was, you know, some members of my family were happier than others. Writing about my unhappy father was no fun. It felt like a you know, he was seriously mentally ill, and that's not something, even at that time, that a lot of people wrote about. And I thought that that was a shame, since so many people suffered from it, both people who were afflicted the most, of course, but also people who were, you know, in their world. And it just felt to me as though it was an exhausting and painful, but ultimately really gratifying thing to do.
And your latest book is a departure because it's about football. Now, George Carlin did a famous bit comparing baseball and football. And you're going to be appearing at the Bergoglio Baseball Clubhouse next week, I believe. And one of the topics of discussion is going to be the difference in writing between baseball and football. So could you give us a little preview of that?
Sure. I mean, they're a world apart. Baseball, I mean, really where it all starts is access. You know, baseball is accessible both as the game is played and also professionally anyway. The characters are all accessible to writers, and there's plenty of time to think about it, and it's, you can see the players, you can understand what's going on. It's all, it seems very clear and transparent. There's no, most people know all the rules. There are always a couple of very obscure rules which almost never come up. Football's a whole different game because it's not transparent. It's all hidden. It's all secret. The players are obscured by masks and armor and, you know, and it's really, really fast. And most people in the game are not accessible to writers. And there are many, many more reasons why football thrives on a lack of accessibility and why that might be attractive to people, but it sure makes it hard for writers. And so I think the fact that baseball writing is far superior to football writing begins with access. In other words, it's not the writer's fault. It's the fault of, it's the nature of the sport. It's really hard to know what's going on, and that's the point.
So what was the point? Is you needed a new challenge?
I guess the point was is that I saw what is the single most popular endeavor in, you know, in sort of American entertainment. I mean, this is what more Americans choose to do with their time than anything. And yet every Sunday when they turned on their television set, they saw these guys with headphones in it, what looked like a diner menu that they held really close to their lips because they didn't want any opposition lip reading. And the entire plan for the game that they were watching was on that sheet. And nobody would know what that sheet was going into the game. And afterwards, they still wouldn't know. So nobody would really know what happened or if what was supposed to happen had really occurred. And it all just felt like this hugely, it felt like something that was hidden in plain sight, and I wanted to see it. And so I hoped to get an NFL. And I'd always wanted to write a book, too, about just a group of guys who, or women, just a group of people who were involved to the exclusion of anything else on some sort of vast project, which they really, really cared about, and which took all their time and brought them in great fulfillment, in part because it was really difficult. And I had tried out just, you know, there were any number, like one book that's a wonderful book is Richard Rhodes's The Making of the Atomic Bomb, all those scientists who are gathered in, you know, at Los Alamos to try and make this, and the many different kinds of people who have to come together to do something that, you know, it just really interested me. And it could have been a bunch of guys at a bar who were just regulars, you know, but whoever it was who were unified by some sort of, again, unifying sense of purpose. And when I met these football coaches, I began to see that these were my regulars. And, you know, the New York Jets were kind enough to, it could have been any team, but the Jets were kind enough to let me do it. And so I just spent ultimately upwards of a year and a half as a basically a shadow member of the Jets coaching staff. And so everything they did, I was there. And I mean, they even let me call plays in an exhibition game. And that was really great because it was a way of, I hoped, bringing people closer to something that they really cared about but didn't necessarily understand as well as they could.
What kind of feedback did you get from the Jets staff after the book came out?
Oh, you know, they were great. I mean, they, you know, they're really proud of what they do, and it's a frustration to these coaches who pour everything into their lives into what they're doing that nobody has any real idea of what they're doing. I mean, they're, you know, they're proud of what they do, and they were glad that somebody was taking it seriously. And you know, there was no bullshit about those guys. I mean, they were really, I thought, frank and candid people, and that there is a bubble of real protection around football didn't mean that the people in it, once you were inside that bubble, were protected. I thought that they were really, really committed to what they do, and they were very generous with their time with me, and they spent an awful lot of time with me helping me to understand something which just really wasn't that easy for me anyway to understand, although I hope the book makes it easy for a reader to understand.
So as an outsider, that you didn't find that they were a little hesitant or suspicious of what you were trying to do?
I'm sure initially there were some who were, but by and large, once, you know, they introduced me at the team meeting, you know, I had to stand up with everybody else and say where I went to college and what my position was, and my, you know, so I just said that my position was I write books. And the whole team, everybody knew. So, and I was there every day, and I think, you know, they work pretty hellish hours, and it's a real sacrifice for everything else in your life to be a football person. And I did the same things they all did.
Did you have to sing?
That's more Paper Lion than Collision Low Crossers. But there was no singing. There wasn't very much hazing, at least with the Jets. There may be elsewhere, but they're kind of past that. I think that they think that that was maybe counterproductive.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you can see in the national reaction to a very different and kind of appalling hazing with Richie Incognito is what happened in Miami, that this is something that the culture has by and large moved past. Even something as, you know, in George Plimpton's Paper Lion, it's pretty charming when he has to sing and other people have to sing. But there is a sort of, there's a current of nastiness under it, which I think a lot of people in football are past.
Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I'm just finishing a large project about the great American photographer Robert Frank.
And that's due for publication sometime in the near future?
He's turning 90. It's a long piece for Rolling Stone, and he's turning 90 in November. So I'm kind of on deadline.
So I will let you get back to it with our thanks. We've been talking to Nicholas Davidoff, author of several wonderful baseball books, including The Catcher Was a Spy and Baseball, a Literary Anthology. Nicholas, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
And that was our conversation with Nicholas Davidoff, author of The Catcher Was a Spy and The Mysterious Life of Mo Berg, editor of Baseball, a Literary Anthology. He will be at the Bugino Baseball Clubhouse this Wednesday, September 10th at 7 o'clock. For more information, call 212-226-7150. He'll be discussing not only his baseball work, but also his football work. He's the author of Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. So I hope to be there, and maybe I'll see you there if you come too. That's it for this time. Remember to visit the blog, Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, for the latest news on baseball books and other items in pop culture. Thanks, everybody. So long.
Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.